Think climate change is a dead issue in America? Think again. Around the country, cities, states, and big companies are throwing their weight behind climate solutions, setting ambitious policy, and investing hundreds of billions of dollars. While federal policy is bogged down in politics, how are these actors keeping America in the game on this critical global issue? Stay tuned for an upcoming special branded episode of Global Translations, brought to you by Citi. We'll hear from Ed Schuyler. He is the Executive Vice President for Global Public Affairs at Citi, and Mike Bloomberg, the former mayor of New York City, about the policy and financial tools we have to meet the scale of our environmental challenges. Listen for that episode on September 5th, wherever you get this podcast.
Nobody is doing enough fast enough.
That's Simon Dalby.
Let's be clear about that.
He's a professor of geography and environmental studies at Wilfrid Laurier University in Ontario. So you study the geopolitics of climate change. What is the geopolitics of climate change? What does that phrase mean?
It means a lot of things, but the guts of it comes down to the simple but very profound important point that the world is changing, and how states respond to the changing world is in turn influencing how that world changes.
We were talking about geopolitics and climate change and winners and losers, and I tried to stump him by asking if the countries of the world today were characters in a novel, who would they be?
That's a really interesting thing. Look, I'm no novel writer, but I mean, the grouchy old grandfather, I think, would be the United States, that still wants to play with V8s. The new kid that wants to play with the new technology would obviously be China, who's going to get increasingly annoyed with grumpy old grandfather. I'm not quite sure where the Canadians fit on this. They'll obviously try to be kinder, gentler, nicer people than everybody else, but given their continued fascination with V8 trucks and badly insulated big houses, they're clearly on the grumpy grandpa side of things rather than the cool tech-savvy teenager. Okay, maybe I should stop before I get further into trying to be a novel writer here.
I want to hear about the Europeans.
The Europeans are bemused and baffled by both the Chinese and the Americans, I think, and will no doubt find other innovative ways to do bicycles and other forms of transportation.
And where do the Russians fit into this family?
Good question. They're clearly the black sheep of the family, I think, at the moment. Still looking to their old role from 20, 30 years ago as a major geopolitical power, not yet completely happy with their much reduced status in the world. And they really are in many ways a sort of a third world power with a whole lot of nuclear weapons. Grumpily, nostalgically backwards, trying to reassert their authority in a world which is passing them by. Does that make them the estranged uncle? I guess it does.
So clearly this stayed on Simon's mind, because a little while later we got an email from him in which he followed up and he said, quote, "Europe is mom. Mom is trying to get everyone playing nice. And that's the Paris Agreement."
It's a deal. Nearly 200 countries reach an historic climate agreement to cut greenhouse gas.
Paris Climate Agreement.
Paris Climate Agreement.
Paris Climate Agreement.
A historic climate agreement in Paris to slow the rise of greenhouse gases. How do you get 195 countries to agree on anything?
Well, here's the thing about the Paris Climate Agreement. Even if it works the way it's supposed to, it's still not enough. Scientists have said we need to keep the increase in global temperatures to within 2 degrees of historical levels. And the Paris Agreement alone won't get us there.
At the end of the day, this was never meant to be an answer to climate change.
Jonathan Pershing, a key U.S. climate negotiator on the agreement, told us as much when we spoke.
It was meant to be an iteration on an effort that will have to be ratcheted up.
Today we're exploring who are the winners and who are the losers as the planet warms. Because climate change is an existential threat to humanity.
The worst drought in California history.
The troubling scale of the Arctic's melting ice
fire
sheets.
Fire ringing Brazil. A record 80,000 fires this year.
Rising sea levels, more frequent rainstorms, even wildfires.
Rising water levels and more extreme weather are eroding coastlines around the world.
A warming climate isn't just causing more weather events like droughts, storms, and fires. It's also fundamentally changing access to resources, everything from water to crops and even new stores of fossil fuels. It's scrambling power dynamics between countries, and it's opening up new shipping routes to global commerce. From Politico, this is Global Translations. I'm Louisa Savage. To discuss all this, I'm joined by Matt Daly, our energy editor at Politico. Matt, thanks for being here.
Hey, it's my pleasure.
Matt, we learned from the last episode that countries around the world are simply not doing enough to head off climate change.
That's right.
It's happening.
Absolutely.
It's here. And it's only going to get worse.
That's what we're expecting, yep.
So I guess the big question is, how will climate change change the world?
Well, you know, as the science has gotten better around climate change, and we're sure and sure about it actually happening and that humans are really the driving factor, it hasn't given us any certainty about what we will be facing, really. We know that temperatures are rising. We know that sea levels are climbing. But how is this going to change our politics? How is this going to change how nations interact? How is this going to change our economy? There will definitely be impacts. There will be massive impacts. But it's really hard to game those out. It's really hard to forecast with any certainty exactly what's going to happen. This is a major area of research right now. People trying to figure out what's going to happen in my community. What's going to happen to my business? How are we going to be relating to our European allies? How are we going to be competing with China? What's going to happen with Russia? All these things are major questions we don't really have the answers to right now.
So that's why for this episode, we sat down with several experts who've been giving this a lot of thought. And one of them is Sherry Goodman. She's a senior fellow at the Woodrow Wilson Center's Polar Institute, and she's also a former deputy undersecretary of defense.
I've always been aware of what are the greatest threats and challenges of the era. You know, my parents were Holocaust refugees, so I was very fortunate that my parents were able to escape. But, you know, more than 6 million did not. And so we need to be aware that those challenges evolve over time from fascism, terrorism, repression. But now, you know, we face a global challenge in climate that doesn't, you know, it's not an enemy because it is us. It's the natural, you know, it's nature, but we are changing it. And so that's in many ways the greatest global challenge of our era.
So this was an absolutely fascinating conversation. Sherry Goodman studies the national security and defense considerations around climate change. Can you talk about how the Pentagon first came to be interested in the security implications of climate change? How did that come about?
Well, the Pentagon did some studies a number of decades ago looking at extreme risks, as is common in national security planning and in what's called net assessment, to look at a variety of risks that might be low probability but high consequence. But the real time, this was sort of back in the 70s and 80s, but the real attention to climate change as a security threat, as we now think of it, came in the 2000s when the CNA Military Advisory Board, a group of a dozen senior retired military leaders, generals and admirals from all the services who served at all the highest levels that I had organized.
And they put together a report that characterized climate change as what they called a threat multiplier.
A threat multiplier for instability in fragile regions of the world, aggravating existing tensions and making current and future security challenges worse. And now we see that this is happening all around the globe. Extreme weather events, sea level rise, extended droughts, higher temperatures all around the planet, just changing the global face of security and making all of our challenges, whether it's terrorism, weapons of mass destruction, violent extremism, or great power competition between China and Russia, that much more challenging.
Is there an example where climate has already been a threat multiplier somewhere around the world in a conflict region or otherwise?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we know that in Syria, the prolonged drought that preceded the civil unrest there was a contributing factor to that unrest, which became instability, which led to the violent extremism, which has become the deadliest civil war in modern times, with many, many killed and many displaced persons and global refugees. And it was the prolonged drought that preceded that conflict when rural herders and farmers who normally had lived peaceably side by side in the drought, as the droughts continued on across several years, they began to flee because there wasn't enough water to support their livelihoods. And they began to move towards the urban areas. And the urban areas also didn't have enough water. And there became hotbeds of civil unrest. So in some ways, it was the underlying conditions of climate induced drought and climate prolonged drought that became the multiplier on that conflict.
And it was quite striking to me, Matt, that the Pentagon has actually spent so much time thinking about climate change.
Yeah, the U.S. military has actually been very forward thinking about this. This is what they do. They plan for these unknown factors. What happens if this happens? What happens if something else happens? This is how they operate. They have to really think strategically about these types of things. And this is why the military has said, look, we need to be preparing not only our bases and our technologies to deal with the changing climate, we need to figure out how this is going to affect our allies and how this is going to affect conflicts in the future.
Yeah, expand on that more.
The countries that are the best positioned to deal with climate change are the richer countries, the countries that have technology and money and they can build this capacity. But the poorer countries, who have done very little to actually contribute to climate change, are the ones suffering, and they're pointing the finger at the developed world and saying, you have to help us. You have the money. You caused the problem. We're the ones that are suffering the most.
And they're suffering because of droughts, because of storms, because of sea level rise.
It's the whole spectrum of things. You've got literally countries that will cease to exist when the water levels rise. They don't even have to be completely submerged. Once the water table on a small island is inundated with salt water, that can prevent those places from being inhabitable. Now you've got an entire region, the Indian subcontinent, that could be really impacted by rising seas as well.
And it's complicated.
It's not that the world is a safe place now and will suddenly become dangerous, but the dangers will be exacerbated by the pressures that climate change is bringing on us as countries face their own internal pressures that range from threats to infrastructure, from increasingly devastating storms, as well as threats to their own ability to produce their food.
I'm Helena Potamiller-Evich, and I cover food and agriculture at Politico.
One of the things she's been reporting on is how climate may actually be affecting the nutritional value of our food.
There's lots of things we do to crops that change their nutrient density. I think what's interesting about the carbon dioxide factor is how pervasive it is. So the whole ecosystem responds in a certain way to rising CO2, and there doesn't seem to be a ton of research looking at all the different ways that that could change all of the plants that we rely on.
Speaking of the long term, you had this extraordinary story about the way climate change is actually changing the nutrition in the food that we grow. Can you explain that?
So as carbon dioxide concentrations increase in the atmosphere, what happens to a lot of different crops is they can actually grow faster. Basically, photosynthesis ramps up the process by which plants use light to grow, but the nutrient density is reduced in a lot of these crops. So a lot of the research has been focused on rice. So looking at whether or not rice will still deliver the same amount of protein and zinc and iron that, you know, it does today or did 20 years ago. And that's less important for us. We don't rely on something like rice for most of our protein. We eat a very varied diet. But for hundreds of millions of people who rely on rice for, you know, more than half their calories, a reduction in protein zinc, iron, or B vitamins, which has been now well documented, could be very important. So scientists are really only beginning to model what those impacts might be. So trying to figure out, okay, if there's a 9% drop in protein in rice due to elevated CO2, and they're able to actually simulate this, what does that mean for, you know, Southeast Asian countries that are extremely dependent on rice? So can we actually measure how many more people are at risk for iron deficiency or zinc deficiency? And we are now starting to see studies that do that.
Coming up, how businesses are preparing for a future of scarcity.
The politics of climate change are frozen in Washington, but beyond the Beltway, action on climate is heating up faster than ever, and you don't have to look far to find it. As America walks away from the Paris Climate Agreement, cities and states are picking up the slack by setting ambitious policy, and so are the world's biggest companies.
A couple things changed. One is everybody started focusing on it, and two is the client demand really picked up.
Ed Schuyler is the Executive Vice President for Global Public Affairs at Citi. In 2014, Citi set a goal of investing $100 billion in environmental finance, and it is about to hit that target 5 years early.
One of the reasons we're able to get to $95.5 billion is because the client demand is there for sustainable transportation, for clean water, for green buildings, sustainable energy, which has increased much sharper than we had forecast.
The advanced energy economy, that's wind, solar efficiency, green buildings, electric cars, and biofuels, are a $238 billion yearly market. That's nearly the size of America's aerospace industry. Former New York City Mayor Mike Bloomberg says all this activity is proof that America is still a leader on climate change, despite the inaction in D.C.
We need action now. And companies started to be much more worried about the environment. Their customers wanted them to do it. Their employees wanted them to do it. And their investors wanted them to do it. And together, we have really done as much as any other country, I think. This world is changing very fast.
I'm Carol Zimmer. Coming up on September 5th, we're releasing our third branded episode of Global Translations, brought to you by our sponsor, Citi. We'll hear from Ed Schuyler and Mike Bloomberg about how cities, states, and financial institutions are setting the stage for a radical shift in energy markets and climate solutions. Stay tuned for our final installment of this branded series, anywhere you listen to this podcast.
It's really very difficult to remove geopolitics from these climate discussions.
Ryan Heath is a senior editor at Politico who spent the last several years covering European politics in Brussels.
Let's take natural gas, for example. That's certainly one of the cleaner fossil fuels, and it would be a great way for Europe to get its emissions down. But one of the very easy ways to do that would be taking more Russian gas, which geopolitically is not where Europe wants to be right now. So there are huge fights over a gas pipeline called Nord Stream 2 that would connect Russia into Germany and the rest of Europe, where really Europe is split down the middle. Half says absolutely no way. This is crazy politics to allow Vladimir Putin that ability to influence our energy mix. And the other half just see a cheap gas supply and a way to meet these climate targets. And so we don't really know what the result is going to be yet.
Yeah, Louisa, it's like Ryan said. On the one hand, the natural gas pipeline that Russia wants to build to Europe will help out on the climate policy. But on the other, it's really dicey politically.
In Business Briefing, trouble in the pipeline.
This is a nasty game of pipeline politics. And where there's oil and gas, there's a lot at stake.
The NATO summit kicking off on a contentious note with President Trump starting a fight with Germany on energy.
Germany is totally controlled by Russia.
German officials deny that the controversial Nord Stream 2 pipeline will allow Russia to exert undue influence over their country.
And when we think about the geopolitics of climate change, a lot of it starts with who's trying to get the upper hand in the Arctic.
The Arctic is really ground zero for the nexus of national security and climate change.
Sherry Goodman.
In our lifetime, a whole new ocean has opened up because with climate change, the sea ice is retreating. The oceans are warming and the permafrost is collapsing. that has made the Arctic more accessible and potentially more navigable. Summer sea ice is retreating to such an extent that there will be months of the year when portions of the Arctic previously foreclosed to ship traffic will be available. And so there is a global quest for resources underway now. There's thought to be vast stores of fossil fuels, oil and gas and minerals across the Arctic that have not yet been tapped. Russia is doing so today across its vast Arctic coastline with the help of China to exploit the liquid natural gas resources at the Yamal Peninsula. China has declared itself to be a near Arctic stakeholder in its first ever Arctic policy issued in January of 2018, and has established what it calls the Polar Silk Road. You may have heard of the Belt and Road Initiative, which is China's effort to create a network of infrastructure, road and rail and ports across much of Asia, stretching to Europe and the Middle East. Well, now it envisions a Polar Silk Road that stretches from Shanghai across potentially to Hamburg and Reykjavik and parts of Europe across Russia's vast northern sea route hugging the Russian coastline, and both exploiting the energy resources there, potential transport opportunities, shipping, research, tourism, maybe the fish in the future. A vast source of protein awaits as fish stocks globally begin to move northward with climate change, and fish stocks in the temperate regions, the equator and the more temperate regions, become more overfished from illegal fishing and human consumption.
So how does Russia feel about China building this polar road?
Well, Russia needs China's money. So Russia welcomes the investment where it enables them to build out their energy and their other infrastructure. Russia envisions under Putin a northern sea route that is essentially a toll road that requires Russian Arctic escorts in the form of icebreakers or other patrol boats, escorting not only the Chinese but others who want to ship across the Arctic. Because remember, shipping times in an open Arctic, which isn't quite there yet, but shipping times from Asia to Europe could be shorter by weeks. Now, again, one shouldn't think that we go from fully ice-clad to no ice. That's not how it works. In fact, it's still going to be a very dangerous environment in which to operate, but it will be more navigable, and China and others have begun to send more vessels through the region, and others are exploring it. So in some ways, it's a marriage of economic convenience, which is often what the Chinese-Russian relationship is. But it is also the case that in this era, where the U.S. attention has somewhat been diverted from attention to the climate risks globally, that we put ourselves more at risk of not understanding what needs we have to be able to be present and operate and project power in the Arctic.
When you look at Vladimir Putin, do you think when he looks at climate change, he sees a threat or an opportunity?
Oh, he sees a vast opportunity to exploit the energy resources in the Arctic. Remember, the Russian identity has long been tied to the Arctic. A considerable portion of their GDP has long come from the Arctic. During the Stalinist era, the Soviet Union created vast cities and required people to go live in fairly inhospitable climates. So he sees opportunity to exploit energy, transportation, power, and purpose.
So, Matt, I was also fascinated by what Sherry Goodman said about Russia. This is a country that does not see eye to eye with the United States, but they see a lot of opportunities here as the North melts, as temperatures increase, and so much of Russia is actually in that area, that they see opportunities economically to develop resources, even fossil fuels, in the North.
Yeah, Russia's got them coming and going. Russia is one of the biggest oil producers in the world, along with the United States and Saudi Arabia. They produce a huge amount of natural gas, which is actually what a lot of countries are shifting to try to reduce their carbon emissions. And as the Arctic warms, it opens up a new shipping lanes, new areas to develop resources. There are major oil exploration projects going on the northern coast of Russia right now that would probably not have been viable even a decade or two ago. And those are only going to open up more. There's going to be a real scramble for resources in the Arctic. And the countries are now trying to position themselves through various ways to make sure that they get a piece of that action.
We're not going to capture the moon tomorrow or live over an asteroid anytime soon.
Gary Littman is at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, an association that advocates for the interests of business.
We have the resources here. We have to figure out how to use it. Who's going to use it? What's the price? What are we doing to prepare? What's the risk? Can we manage that risk?
He's the vice president for global initiatives, where he's responsible for the policy advocacy around the G20, the G7, and international financial institutions. But a major focus of his is preparing businesses for an era of dwindling natural resources.
You cannot address the climate issue, right? You cannot prepare, for example, for the rise of the oceans if you don't invest in new construction materials. How do you build the dam? If you use the current resources, you'll run out of gravel before you build anything.
Climate is only a small part of the problem for Gary. He worries about how will we build renewable technologies when critical resources like cobalt are shrinking.
If you don't have access to reliable supply of cobalt, you won't be able to switch to e-mobility. You'll have to find substitution. What's the substitution? Some other metal. Where is it? Not here. Is somebody making it? No. Is somebody planning for it? No. Is anyone financing for it? Yes, China is. We are not. So climate is an issue. It's a challenge. It's one of many challenges we have. But we should look at that as business, where we can provide solutions that are based on our economic models and actually make a difference.
And so if we don't do this and this doesn't happen, we know that the world, the earth, the access to resources, the seas, this is all changing. It's changing now. What are some of the big threats that will face the United States as these changes accelerate?
Energy is not a limited resource. You can shift between different sources of energy, but ultimately there is no shortage of energy. Whereas there are other resources that we depend on every day that are finite and getting used up, or price of which may go up or be very volatile. And my focus is to make sure that that conversation doesn't get lost.
You know, Matt, we started this entire podcast looking at the huge tectonic shift in relations between the United States and China and how that's impacting the rest of the world. And it was in issues like trade and obviously in technology. And it's a huge issue in climate change, because this is not a problem that can be solved without the United States and China, the world's two biggest emitters. And as we were going along in the podcast, I got a really interesting email.
So my name is Ali Wine. I'm a policy analyst at the RAND Corporation.
The reason I was so happy that Ali reached out was because it took me back to the big question we started with when we launched this show. And that's fundamentally rethinking the relationship between China and the U.S.
If we are going to be embarking on a fundamentally different relationship with China, if we are going to be adopting a much more competitive strategy towards China, we really need to do our homework analytically and prescriptively. We really need to think about a number of questions. The Trump administration doesn't want to look weak vis-a-vis Beijing. President Xi doesn't want to appear, you know, weak to his constituents. And so neither side wants to be seen as compromising. But after a certain period of bluster and bravado, I would hope, I don't know if this will actually be the case, but I would hope that both countries would recognize, look, okay, we've we've done tit for tat, tariff retaliation. We have blacklisted some of each other's big companies. But now we actually really need to sit down and talk. We can't make progress on big issues unless we cooperate. And that's a wishful point of view, perhaps. But I do think that salvaging – so if I were in Washington or Beijing and instead of making a list of big questions and big ticket agenda items to how can we move this relationship forward, I think very near the top of my list would be what are some intermediate forms of interdependence. It's a convoluted way of saying I don't have an answer, but it's something that I've been thinking about more and more, and I'm very eager to talk with people and see people who are far smarter and to see what solutions or ideas they have.
So Matt, Ali makes the case that what we really need is cooperation between the United States and China on climate change, but we seem to be headed in the opposite direction.
Yeah, I mean, if you're looking at this with a Cold War mentality and you only see Russia and China only as opponents in this, one trying to get the leg up over each other. It's one of the reasons there's been blowback in the U.S. Opponents of climate action say China is getting ahead of the U.S. That competition undermines any kind of global effort. Climate change is a global problem. And the real question is can we get past the competition aspect and learn to deal with it collaboratively?
Thanks so much, Matt. And thanks for being with me on this episode.
Hey, it's my pleasure. Thanks.
Thanks for being with us for this chapter of Global Translations. And if you like what you heard, please leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. And stay tuned, because we'll be back. Our producer is Annie Reese. We had help on this episode from Adrian Hurst. Dave Shaw is the executive producer of Politico Audio. My thanks to my colleagues,
Matt Daly,
Helena Bottomiller-Evich,
Ryan Heath.
I'm Louisa Savage. Global Translations is presented by Citi, a leading global bank. Subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And if you're listening on Politico.com, go to Politico.com/globaltranslations to learn how to download the show to your phone. And listen for a branded episode from Citi about some of these same themes coming Thursday, September 5th.